This webcast is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Steinway & Sons is a proud sponsor of the ASCAP Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson broadcast award-winning program Between the Keys, featuring Jed Distler. More information about Steinway & Sons, makers of handcrafted pianos since 1853, is available at www.steinway.com. This is Jed Distler, artist in residence for the Classical Network, and I'm happy you've joined me for Between the Keys. Pianist Emmanuel Ax is going to be my special guest this hour. He has been one of the most admired pianists and musicians on the international scene for more than four decades. He has collaborated with everyone from Yo-Yo Ma to the Marc Morris Dance Company and with just about every leading orchestra and conductor on the planet, all over the world. This year, Sony BMG will be issuing a box set that encompasses all of the pianist's recordings for the RCA Victor label, a body of work that spans from the mid-1970s to the mid-1990s. I was asked to write the booklet notes for this upcoming release, and I interviewed Emmanuel Ax about these recordings. And since I've been wanting to have him as a guest on Between the Keys for quite a long time, we both decided that it might be a good idea to record our conversation and to air it on the show. And I thought that was a tremendous idea. So we're going to get to our conversation in a moment, but first, here's a selection from the pianist's 1975 solo debut release for RCA Victor, the Liszt Paganini Etude in A minor, The Theme and Variations, pianist Emmanuel Ax. Thank you. pianist Emmanuel Axe performing Franz Liszt's Paganini Etude No. 6 in A minor, the theme and variations. And we began our conversation on the topic of his early recordings. Emmanuel Axe, welcome to Between the Keys. Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you very much for asking me to do that.
And it's just wonderful to be with you. And Sony BMG is bringing out a box set of your complete RCA Victor recordings. And I think that spans from maybe 1974 or 75 through 1994. That's 20 years of work.
Is it as much as that? Wow.
What goes through your mind when you encounter your older recordings?
Well, honestly, I don't listen to them very often. Most of the stuff from that time I haven't heard at all since I made them, I guess. Sometimes it's just the first recording I made had a couple of Liszt etudes on it.
Yes, yes.
And I have to say, I'm amazed that I could actually get through them. Because I don't know that I could today anymore, but they sound okay. And so
indeed,
I'm quite impressed with just the fact that I got from beginning to end, and they're quite fast. And
and also you had some Schubert Liszt songs. And what was interesting is that at the time of that recording, this repertoire was not really so fashionable. It was maybe out of fashion. Now the transcription repertoire is much more in favor.
I think for two reasons. One, the fact that my teacher was from that era, Mieczysław Munz, was very much part of Rachmaninoff, Hoffman, as being the two giants, I guess, when he was young. So he obviously loved all that music, and I remember learning, because he told me to, the Invitation to the Dance of Weber, but not just the Weber, it was the Tausig transcription of that piece, which has more notes and so forth.
Yes, well, Benno Moiseevich made a fantastic
recording. And Munz, I guess, used to play it when he was younger. And I think one of the reasons there's more interest in that music today is simply that everyone plays the piano so amazingly now. Everyone plays as though there's nothing hard anymore. So
it's true. When you think about the Godofsky Etudes, when we were kids, the idea of anyone even playing them at half tempo seemed like absolutely inconceivable.
Yeah, there were just two or three pianists that we always referred to that played that music and said it's unplayable except by these three people.
Right.
Now it's kind
everybody plays.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Well, since we are going back, I know that you are a musician who prefers to go forward rather than to go back, because you're always taking on new works and nurturing young artists. But getting back to the early 60s, when you moved to New York with your parents, what was the piano scene like in those years?
Well, when I guess we got here in 1962, I was 12. I was able to take lessons at Juilliard Prep. And that was Saturdays for kids not in college, you know,
I went there too.
Right, so you know what it was like.
Right.
And I guess I met very early on Garrick Olson, has been a great friend over the years. We met because we both kind of haunted Carnegie Hall. Whatever we could get into, you know, there used to be a door. If you went to the recital hall, which is now Weill Hall, the entrance that, and you went to the third floor, there was always a fire escape door that was slightly ajar, and you could get into the dress circle for no money. So I went to many, many concerts in the dress circle of Carnegie Hall.
Who'd you sneak in to hear? Anything that still stands out for
Well,
you?
The first person I ever heard play at Carnegie, and I think I was 12, was Samson Francois.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Like you
he came. He came to New York. Of course, I was too young to really know, you know, what
to
play.
Differentiate.
Yeah, what it represented. But it was amazing to see a piano and this man from way up high. It was a fantastic experience.
Yeah. I think my first professional piano concert was André Watts.
Wow.
And he was wearing concert tails, and he was so elegant.
Yes.
And the idea that somebody could make a living like this and look so cool yet be so accessible made such an impression on me.
Yeah, I completely
this
understand
was when I was
that.
11,
he was, well, he was a hero of mine too. I think he's only maybe a year older or two, mm-hmm. two at the most, I think.
Right. But then it seems that at Juilliard, and you're talking about Garrick Olson, there seems to be a whole coterie of pianists who were at Juilliard in the late 60s who've really gone on to really distinctive musical lives. And I'm thinking of, you know, obviously Garrick Olson you knew earlier on,
right.
but there was also Joseph Villa.
Of course,
a great
friend.
I knew him so well, but was Margaret Langtan there when you were?
Yes, Margaret was there.
And Jerry Kuderna.
Jerry Kuderna
like
was there.
One of my closest friends.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Joe Villa was a very close friend of, of Garrick's and mine and David Golub.
Who
was one of my closest friends.
I loved his playing.
Yeah, he died at the age of 51.
I know.
And not only was he an extraordinary pianist, but he was becoming a marvelous conductor.
He was learning and
doing that. He did some amazing recordings and concerts as a conductor.
Joseph Kalkstein,
a couple of years ahead of me, but he's someone I talk to every other day.
Mm-hmm.
We're very, very close friends.
Because there must have, but what was in the water supply that really informed all of you? This is like the greatest generation, the same way.
Well, I wonder if there hasn't always been a group of good pianists in every generation.
Well, you think about OYAPs. You think about Gary Graffman and Julius Katchen.
Right.
And
Leon Fleischer.
And Bob Helps was sort of part of that.
John Browning.
Oh, right, of course.
Van Cliburn.
Exactly. I mean,
All sort of that same
Paul Jacobs.
Period, exactly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Fabulous group. And of course, today, there is a plethora of fabulous pianists.
Well, I think if you think about the class of Juilliard born in 1972, there's like a whole superstar level. Like there's a certain group who, you know, they have this. But I was just wondering if it was the training or the sensibility or the influence.
I think maybe, I don't know, New York was, of course, a wonderful place to be.
For
a piano player, yeah, mm-hmm. absolutely. Because you had the possibility to hear the greatest performers regularly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm someone who heard Horowitz a number of times.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
I heard Rubinstein many times.
Mm-hmm.
I heard Richter play 5 piano recitals.
Mm-hmm.
I heard Gil Els play at least 2 or 3 piano recitals. I mean, these were all, and of course the young Ashkenazi, the young Pollini. So if you learned, as we all do, to some degree by imitation, this was the place to be. And you know, every day you'd hear one of these concerts, and the next morning you'd wind up saying, I want to play like that.
Yes.
And you'd try and copy it, and you couldn't, of course. But
right.
then you'd hear someone else the next night who said, no,
and they
I want to
play,
like that instead.
And they play very differently.
They were all their own world, every one of them.
Mm-hmm. You don't have that quite as much now as you... I mean, you still have it, but...
I think it's probably still there. I think partly I'm so awed by the sheer velocity and dexterity of the playing today, that I'm impressed with everybody.
Well, I think Mr. Rubinstein used to say that. He said
really?
That I think there is the story, which is corroborated, that when Pollini won the
Chopin competition,
Rubinstein said, that boy plays better than all of us on the jury.
I kind of understand that. Of course, I have to say he was quite wrong about that. What I mean is you can't play any better than Rubinstein. It doesn't make any sense.
Well, you met Mr. Rubinstein when you were a teenager, I think.
I met him once when I was 13 or so.
Was he a friend of your father's?
No, not at all. He was usually very kind about meeting young pianists, I think. And I think somebody must have told him this young boy was in Poland, mm-hmm. and he's, you know, you're his hero and so forth. Mm-hmm. He invited my father and me to mm-hmm. his fabulous apartment on Park Avenue, mm-hmm. which I guess is long gone in terms of Rubinstein. Mm-hmm. I remember I played for him just one piece. It was the Beethoven Sonata, Opus 14, Number 2, the G major. That's the one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he was very kind. You know, said, oh, yes, he's a very, very gifted young boy. It's very nice. And he gave me a copy of a new record that he had just made, or that had just come out, the Grieg Concerto.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. It was a beautiful...
Was this the one where they had the blurb saying, this is the best concerto record I ever made?
That's the one. And it was a beautiful edition, sort of folded out with a booklet and so forth. And he signed it, and I still have
How wonderful.
It was very lovely.
And did he remember you when you were participating in the first competition under his name?
Amazingly, he remembered
somehow.
And I don't think it was because I was especially good at 13 or anything. Mm-hmm. He just had a fabulous memory. And, of course, I spoke Polish to him then, and I spoke Polish to him in Israel in 1974. Mm-hmm. And he was very lovely, and he said, well, you've certainly improved since then. So that was very nice.
And
then I had some lessons with him afterwards.
Was that part of the prize, or this was just something?
No, he was just very kind. He said, when I come to New York next, he came for a long tour, his last tour. Mm-hmm. He said, when I come, please come and see me and play for me, and I'd like to talk to you. And he was mm-hmm. extremely kind.
What was it like playing for him? I remember you were telling me a long time ago about playing the Ravel Valse Noble,
exactly. Yes.
Which you did record.
Right, right.
And but I think that our listeners should know something about this, because the impression was always that Rubinstein played very effortlessly and spontaneously, yet he worked quite hard.
I think he worked very hard in a certain way. He was probably one of the most gifted pianists of all time. Mm-hmm. So whatever work he did, in terms of hours, I don't know. But mm-hmm. what was amazing to me was how much time he spent on literally note by note, you know, saying, now this note is too loud because of what you did here. Here you have to bring out the thumb. Here you need to wait a little bit. I mean, it was so precise and exact.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. So the way he at least told me to work on the piece, mm-hmm. and obviously he did the same thing, was he worked in incredibly precise detail. I must say, when you hear the way he played, I understand that. The playing is, on the one hand, totally inspired, but on the other hand, completely controlled. And in a great performance, that's what you need, both.
Thank you.
We just heard music by Johannes Brahms, the Intermezzo in E-flat, Opus 117, number 1, performed by Emmanuel Axe, whom I've been speaking with in a conversation recorded not too long ago in New York City. We'll get back to our conversation momentarily, but first let me remind you that you are listening to Between the Keys, and I'm your host, Jed Distler, artist in residence for the Classical Network. I interviewed Emmanuel Axe about an upcoming box set release encompassing his complete recordings for the RCA Victor label, which include a good number of works by Frédéric Chopin. So let's hear Chopin's Ballade No. 3 in A flat major, Opus 47, Emmanuel Axe at the piano.
Thank you.
Music of Chopin, the Ballade No. 3 in A-flat, Opus 47, with pianist Emmanuel Ax. Manny is a fervent champion for the music of his time, and I think one of the most exciting and effective works written especially for him is the three-movement piano concerto called Century Rolls, composed by John Adams. Let's hear the third and final movement, which is subtitled Hail Bop. The Cleveland Orchestra, conducted by Christoph von Dohnányi, with piano soloist Emmanuel Ax. Thank you. finale from John Adams' three-movement piano concerto titled Century Rolls, a work written for and performed on this recording by pianist Emmanuel Ax with the Cleveland Orchestra, conducted by Christoph von Dohnányi. Let's return to my conversation with Emmanuel Ax that took place December 11th in New York City. What else did you play for Mr. Rubinstein, do you remember?
The Brahms D minor concerto was the first thing that we worked on.
Interesting. Yeah. And
because was that one of the concertos that I played in the final of the competition. Mm-hmm. And he remembered it very well. The first thing he asked me when I came, he said, "Now why do you start? When you start, why do you begin so quickly?" And of course, I had all my theories. You know, I said, "Well, maestro, it's because we're all speaking in Polish, of course." Mm-hmm. I said, "Well, it's because the cellos play this thing in the in the line, and my left hand has to then follow the line that the cellos have set mm-hmm. up." Whereupon he said something that completely blew my mind. I could say,
"What was
he
that?"
said, "When my great acquaintance and Joseph Joachim conducted this piece, this is what he did. He made a ritenuto." So the important thing to me was not that he suggested the ritenuto, which I also understood, mm-hmm. but the fact that this was a man who actually knew Joseph Joachim. I mean, the connection was so... I mean, Joachim was
yes.
Brahms's great friend.
Of course.
And here's, you're talking to a great, great pianist.
So you're really getting it from the horse's mouth.
Absolutely.
And also, and Brahms was still alive when Rubinstein
yes.
was a kid. So this was contemporary music.
I think Rubinstein met him when he was 4 years old or something.
Maybe.
You know, not as a pianist. I think he was just somewhere and Brahms mm-hmm. patted him on the head or something like that.
Right. But still, yeah,
it's incredible.
Yeah, I mean, I know Schnabel used to hang out with Brahms.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's just amazing.
Yeah, yeah, because we don't think yeah. of that as contemporary yeah. music.
Right.
But also for Rubinstein, Ravel was his contemporary. He was
yes.
10 years...
This for him was new music. So yeah. Ravel, Defaya, Debussy, this was
Prokofiev,
all music that
yeah.
that to
Shimonovsky,
us, yeah, to
indeed.
Us would have been Fredrikjevsky,
of course,
or you know yeah. John Adams,
and right,
that
exactly.
is exactly the same relationship.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
yeah. One question I want to ask you because I want to talk also about the Chopin concertos, which you have been playing forever and ever. And your first concerto recording was with Eugene Normandy. Actually, you did yeah. both Chopin concertos.
Yeah.
What was it like to work with Eugene Normandy? Had you worked with him before the recording?
No. One of the prized things that came from the Rubinstein was an appearance with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
Oh, I see.
But it was a summer thing. Mm-hmm. And Michael Tilson Thomas conducted that mm-hmm. concert. And I played the Liszt Second Concerto. But this mm-hmm. was a couple of years later. Again, Tom Shepard took the first recording I made, brought it to Ormandy, and said, "I just want you to hear this." And apparently Ormandy said, I like it, and I'll work with him. Let's do a record. And so I got this call, "Well, you're going to play with the Philadelphia Orchestra in Ormandy and record the Chopin F minor." It was an amazing mm-hmm. idea to have that opportunity. To me, he was very kind. Mm-hmm. I don't know if he was always kind, but certainly he was kind to me. He lived in, I don't know, people probably wouldn't know it, but it was on Rittenhouse Square, mm-hmm. a place called the Barclay, which is now
a
condominium building,
yes.
but it used to be mm-hmm. a hotel and have apartments in it as well.
Mm-hmm.
And he lived there. I guess people who played with the orchestra also stayed there. It was pretty fancy, at least to me. Mm-hmm. At the time, it was incredible.
How did you feel about recording in general? And, you know, we were talking early about tape splicing versus digital technology, because the Chopin F minor was still analog, but then when you did the E minor, digital had just kicked in.
Yeah.
I think
that was amazingly enough, the editing was still done by cutting the tape.
Mm.
It was digital recording, but I think the editing was still spliced. The whole process for me was always terrifying and still is to some degree. Mm. I'm getting better about the whole thing, probably because of my friend Yo-Yo. He's so unstressed about recording. It's just wonderful.
I want to ask you one more question. And, you know, you've been interviewed so much that you were probably public domain. What would you want interviewers to ask you that no interviewers have asked you before?
Wow. Boy, that's tough to answer that sort of sideways. What I wind up wanting to talk about actually is the great pianist that I've heard and mm-hmm. that I admire, and the great young pianist that I've heard and that I admire. So mm-hmm. I could just go on for hours and hours and hours of performances that I remember, of people that I've worshipped over the years. Mm-hmm. I'm a piano buff.
I think we both
are.
I know. Yeah.
I think in that way we're very similar.
Yeah.
Because I think we could literally probably spend a week.
I think we could, and we would alienate everybody else in the room.
Yeah.
You know, so
it would be incredibly boring.
At least we're not talking about fingerings.
Right, that's true. Although I will tell you a story. I mean, it doesn't have to be on tape,
sure.
But there's,
right.
I have a friend, Julian Krieger. You probably,
you
know
of
Julian.
Course. Yes, absolutely.
So they're both lawyers, he mm-hmm. and his wife. You know, whenever I'm there, we're always, this is what we talk about. You know, mm-hmm. do you know the Horowitz recording from 48 of this? And mm-hmm. I like the one from 53 better and all of, mm-hmm. And once at dinner, I said to Judy, I said, mm-hmm. you know, you must be so sick of this. It must be unbelievably boring for you. Whereupon she says, after lunch today, nothing could be boring. So don't worry about it. I said, what do you mean? Said, well, you know, Julian's other hobby is collecting fountain pens. And today, she said, we had lunch with a guy who specializes in which ink goes into which fountain pen.
Oh, my goodness.
She said, after this, nothing is boring. It's fine.
Right. Manny Axe, I want to thank you so much again for speaking with me, and thank you very much for being here.
It's my privilege. Thank you very much.
Since we began this program with a selection from this pianist's very first recording, I thought we should conclude with an excerpt from the most recent Immanuel Axe release on the Sony Classical label. It's devoted to all three piano trios by Johannes Brahms. We're going to hear the Allegro Molto Finale from the Trio No. 3 in C Major, Opus 87. Violinist Leonidas Kavakos, cellist Yo-Yo Ma, and at the piano, Immanuel Axe. the Allegro Molto from the Trio No. 3 in C major, opus 87 by Johannes Brahms, with violinist Leonidas Kavakos, cellist Yo-Yo Ma, and our featured artist this past hour, pianist Emmanuel Axe. I would like to thank Manny for being so gracious and generous with his time, for joining us on Between the Keys, which is an exclusive production of the Classical Network and WWFM.org. This is Jed Disler, artist in residence for the Classical Network. Until next time, stay well and please be kind. I think we should let Emmanuel Axe have the last word with the C major intermezzo, opus 119, No. 3 by Johannes Brahms.